whole person by some of the most gifted and insightful and successful medical doctor practitioners there are. Give a call now, 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950, and get for $100, that's all, 3.5 hours of preventing and reversing. You heard me right. You heard it. Reversing diabetes naturally. Thank you all very much.
Absolutely.
Nice day, everyone.
Thank you so much, Gary. Thank you so much. And thank all of you who are calling right now. Please continue to call over this commercial-free, listener-sponsored radio station, WBAI.
And the number to call to show your support to this radio station, again, is 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. Okay, moving on. It is 3 p.m. Stay tuned for Vantage Point with the Professor Ron Daniels here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned.
Good afternoon. This is the Professor Dr. Ron Daniels, President of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century and Distinguished Lecturer Emeritus from York College, City University of New York, welcoming you to this May 16th edition of Vantage Point here on 99.5 FM. That's WBAI on the Pacifica Network in collaboration with YCRadio.org. That's right. The York College radio station is plugged into this conversation. Well, we're going to have a great show today. I hope so. We're going to be talking about understanding Haitian Flag Day. Haitian Flag Day is this coming the 18th. I think that's on Thursday, if I recall. Well, it may be actually Wednesday. And then on the 19th is Malcolm X Day. And we're going to remember Malcolm by way of two guests. Well, first of all, shortly we'll be hearing from Dr. Leon Panfil. And he will be talking about Haitian Flag Day. And then our own Professor James Small will be talking to us about We Remember Malcolm and the pilgrimage and other activities for this coming Thursday, if you will. Before we get into the meat of the program, however, just our prayers and thoughts go out to the families in Buffalo, New York. Another horrific tragedy. Suggest that really black lives don't matter in these United States of America. One could also say that is the same for others that white nationalists want to replace, if you will, be they Latinos, Asians, Native Americans, Jews, Muslims. We have a terrible, terrible situation on our hands. And what it really says is, John Henry Clark, we talked about him, he is one of his most popular lectures that we have featured here on WBAI, is White Nationalism, the Enemy of Black Nationalism. And of course, we see white nationalism in its full bloom. We need to beware of the enemy within. Beware the enemy within. And indeed, that means we need to be aware of white nationalism, and we need to resist it by any means necessary, because it is an existential threat to the United States of America. It is an existential threat to black people, brown people, and those that we also talked about. They are talking about the whole question of displacement theory. They now have a word for it. We talked about the browning of America, the fear of too many black and brown and other people coming into this country is now been operationalized in a terminology that is being blasted out of Fox News, America One, all of these right-wing echo chamber networks. It is a serious danger. Lastly, let me just quickly say that tomorrow, May 17th, is an anniversary of Brown versus Board of Education, significant date in the history of these United States of America. Brown versus Board of Education overturned Plessy versus Ferguson. It launched really the modern era of the civil rights movement. And of course, May 18th, Haitian Flag Day. May 19th is, of course, Malcolm X Day. We'll be talking about the latter two. And finally, COVID is upticking. It has not gone away. It looks like it's not going to go away. So we strongly suggest that you boost up if you believe in vaccinations. Many people don't, or some don't. But if you do, get that third shot or fourth shot, whatever's necessary. But I say mask up at a minimum to protect yourself, but most importantly, protect others, your seniors, your families, your neighbors, particularly the elders. Mask up at a minimum. All right, we want to move forward with our show today. And again, our lead topic is understanding Haitian Flag Day. And no better person, at least in my circle of contacts and friends, to discuss this topic than Reverend Dr. Leon Pamphill. He is a noted scholar. He is someone who has written extensively about the relationship of African Americans and Haitian Americans, and he has a huge humanitarian project that he has been doing for many, many, many years. And I've had the privilege of going with him, or he with us, to Haiti. In fact, one of the most memorable times was, in fact, the really literally months before the tragic earthquake struck. So, Dr. Leon Pamphill, welcome to Vantage Point.
Thank you. Let me emphasize my gratitude for this gracious introduction from a good friend, Dr. Juan Daniels, a valiant fighter for the cause of freedom and the cause of the Haitian people. It's good to be with you, Juan.
All right, good. Well, it's good to be with you also. So what I'm going to do is a little background piece quickly. We could take a whole show in a couple of days to talk about your work and whatever. But in fact, I'm going back through my memory. I can't even remember how we first met each other, and that's sort of it's irrelevant. But I would like to just delve into your background a little bit because you've done such extraordinary work. Were you actually born in Haiti or born here in the U.S.? Yes, let's start with that.
I was born and educated in Haiti, and really, I am thankful for the education I have received. I received a free education in Haiti, public school and university. So
what part of Haiti? For some of your Haitian comrades who are listening in, was it Port-au-Prince? Was it up north in Cape Haitien? Was it down south? Or where were you born?
I was born in the county of Pétionville, that's up the mountain.
Oh, yes.
Let me tell you the story of my life. Here, you know, education is a right. Everybody has a right on education. But for us, for me in Haiti, it was a privilege. I attended a world school, you know, two warm schools in the country, and I was discovered by the principal who urged my father to send me to school in Port-au-Prince. So I left home when I was 12 years old to go down to Port-au-Prince to school. It's a journey. We don't want to get into details of all that. But I did attend the Lycée Pétion, historical Lycée Pétion. And I attended the law school in Haiti. I graduated from the law school. And also École Normale Supérieure, which is the school of education in Haiti.
Right.
So this is my background in Haiti. I don't want to take all the time to talk about
that. No, it's important because we'd like to know what influences people, because obviously one of the things that you have done is you become very active. Not everybody who gets a good education devotes their education to fighting for their people, though many Haitians do, or organizing or writing and using their talent and their skills, you know, to really, really be effective. So it is good to get that snippet, that bio sketch, if you will, in terms of your background. Now we want to turn to Haitian Flag Day, because it's interesting. On the 18th, we have Haitian Flag Day, and the 19th, we have Malcolm X Day, and I've always wanted to sort of connect the two in some ways. But tell us, what is Haitian Flag Day?
Looking at Haitian Flag Day, I can briefly present it to our listeners. First, see what is the flag and the history behind it and the significance of the flag.
Yes, that's what we want to hear.
Okay, well, the flag is called a bicolor, le bicolore, and it features two horizontal bands, and the colors are blue and red. And at the center of the flag is what we call it trophy of weapons. And the other symbol in there is the royal palm, okay? And there is an inscription in there that was done by Pétion, President Pétion. He said, l'union fait la force. I will come back to that.
Yes.
So, you know, during the War of Independence, people, they were not organized at first, but it is recorded there were two flags. The mulattoes had the flags, and the black they have a flag. So there was a special congress in Akaye. Akaye, that's the place of birth of the Haitian flag. It's a town about 80 kilometers from Port-au-Prince. So there was this meeting of Haitian leaders, and Dessalines became the new leader to carry the flag of the War of Independence. And it is recorded that in Akaye, it took the French flag. The French flag has three colors, white and blue and red. So Dessalines, in a brisk move, he took that French flag and he transformed it, okay? Mm-hmm. He took out the red part, and he kept the red and the blue. So that symbolizes the two groups carrying out the War of Independence. You know, the Haitian society at the time was divided into class, and you have the white, you have the blacks, and you have the mulattoes. For people who are probably not too familiar with that historical reality, Africans, they were unfortunately imported from Africa to work on the plantations, of course, in America, in the Caribbean, and in Haiti. Then you have the white planters owning plantations, and also the administrators of the colonial society. So they also they didn't accept black as equal. However, they were involved with black women, African women.
Mm-hmm.
And we have the example. Just look at Monticello and Thomas Jefferson. Okay?
Right.
That's an example illustration of what I'm trying to say. So from that, from the relationship between white and blacks, the sexual promiscuity between them emerged that third group called the mulattoes. But the mulattoes, they were not accepted by blacks. They didn't extend to them equality or freedom. So they had to cast the lot, if I want to put it that way, with the blacks in order to fight for freedom and ultimately the independence of Haiti. So, the flag, let's get back to the flag. The flag, I said, was created by Dessalines by ripping off the white section, and then he gave it to a lady called Catherine Flon, F-L-I-O-N. She became the historical figure of stitching the flag. And so historically, the blue stands for the black, and the red and for the brown or for the mulattoes, whichever way you want to call them. Let's see. There is some kind of evolution in the history of the flag. After, later on, there was a Dessalines changed the color. Okay, of the blue, he replaced it by black cloth. But these two was replaced after his death by the blue came back, and I think survived all the way to Duvalier. Duvalier, he went back to the black and red flag. But anyway, this is the flag itself, okay, and then summing up how it came about. And third, for me, the significance of the flag, I really believe if we would apply that, Haiti would have flourish, would have been a flourishing nation. It said, l'union fait la force. It said, unity makes strength. Unfortunately, this is what we do not have in Haiti. We have not had it through the years, and even now, we still don't have it.
Right. So once again, it's out of unity, it's strength, or that approximation is the idea between the sectors. If these sectors would unite, this would be the force, the strength of Haiti and the flag. So on this coming, the 18th, what happens in various cities and places? Are there celebrations? Are there ceremonies? How is it celebrated?
When I was growing up, Flag Day, and I should add beside that, one in 1919, you probably know about Dantès Bellegarde. He was a great nationalist, and he fought hardly the Americans, primarily in the area of education. So he added to the Flag Day. He added to the flag the day for university. Mm-hmm. So it's the flag and university day. And his objective was to encourage Haitian, primarily Haitian teachers and historians, to give less consideration to French history and more to African civilization and Haitian history.
Wow.
And, you know, the occupation really kindled a fire of nationalism in Haiti, and for the promotion of black culture. But let me say, it's a Haitian flag and university day. My goodness, in the 60s, in the 70s, it was a big day. Mm. At that time, you know, you have peace, and I remember all schools and with bands would gather in front of the National Palace for a big party and speeches. But unfortunately, you know, Haiti, it's sad to say, it's a lawless country, you know. And I remember that President Jovenel Moïse, he couldn't even go to Akaye. That's the birthplace of the flag for the celebration, because gang violence and for his own security. But in good days, that's the way Flag Day was celebrated in all cities around the country.
What about here in the U.S.? Because I remember pre-COVID, because I had the opportunity to march and be a part of it. Typically, there would be like a parade in Brooklyn on Flag Day. I wonder what happens in places like Miami. Are there celebrations in those cities?
Yes, I think you said it right. The Associate Flag Day, they have a special name for it, but it's a they take it as an opportunity to promote Haitian culture and Haitian history and Haitian cuisine. Those three elements, that's the way it's being celebrated here in America.
Right.
In Haitian communities.
Dr. Pamphile, we just have a few minutes left because, like I said before, we could talk for a long, long time. I wish you would just, in a succinct way, talk about your book and how you became interested in the relationship between Haitians and African Americans.
Well, this is a beautiful story. Let me tell you, being from Haiti, I am never far from it. I was influenced by a history teacher. You know, education, when you find the right teachers, this is extraordinary. He instilled in me the love of country. So, although I left Haiti looking for better opportunity, but I never forget my roots. And as you said at the beginning of the program, I have been working very hard to promote education, literacy, and healthcare, and we have a website that describes what we do. It's called flmhaiti.org. Maybe somebody would like to support this work.
Yeah, flmhaiti.org, yes.
Yes, flmhaiti.org. So, it is in my love for Haiti, and I came here and I discovered African Americans. Now, I wrote a paper. I was doing research at seminary. And I, of course, being from Haiti, I wanted, you're looking for things related to your roots and to your culture. So I can't remember exactly the title of the book, but it opened my eyes on the connection between Haitians and African Americans. So this became a passion for me to explore further that relationship. And behold, it is a rich relationship which is chronicled in my book called Haitians and African Americans, published in, by the University Press of Florida in, I believe, 2003. Time flies.
Yes, it does, yes.
And let me see. I get to know you through an article you wrote in the Pittsburgh Courier, okay? And I think, if I'm not mistaken, is the Haitian Revolution is an unfinished task.
Yes.
Okay, you remember that article?
Oh, yes, very much so, yes.
And so I see right there the connection, your connection with Haiti. And I believe I sent you a copy. I thought you would be interested in that book, Haitian and African Americans. And I don't know how I find your address. But I did send you a copy of the book, and I believe you became interested, and you invited me to be the keynote speaker when we have the, a seminar in Washington, that was in preparation for the journey to Haiti. You remember?
Yes, yes, yes.
On the occasion
we're about out of time, but let me just say that, yes, I read the book. I loved the book. I purchased several copies of the book. I sent it around to people, not the least of which was the Minister for Haitians Living Abroad, the Honorable Leslie Voltaire, and have you speak on it, because it is a really fascinating book that really, really talks about this relationship, how rich and deep and strong it is. So as we conclude, tell people, I assume it's still in publication, how can people get the book?
People can get it at the University Press of Florida or on Amazon.
Amazon.
Okay. You can order it on Amazon. Even Barnes and Nobles, I believe you can order it. It's not readily available, but they will have it printed for you. Like this morning, I ordered 5 copies, and I called directly to the University Press of Florida.
Right.
But if they can also reach out to me, and I can order that for them. And we can give them my information, my phone number, okay? And it can be done.
Okay, well, let's get that number out right now so I can so people can reach out to you, but they can also go to the website to support the humanitarian work that you've done for so many years. That's flmhaiti.org. I think that stands for Functional Literacy Ministries, if I recall correctly.
All right, you got it.
So anyway, give you a number so people can reach out to you if they get a copy of the book.
Yes, my number is 412-784-0342.
All right.
And let me repeat.
412-784-0342.
Right.
All right. Well, we'll get that information. We'll share that information to people. I'll repeat it during the course of the show. But Dr. Panfil, to you, thank you so much for all the work that you've done over the years and your continuing uplifting of Haiti. And we look forward to continuing our relationship as we're going to be resuming some of our tours to Haiti, to the Citadel, and some of the work that we've been doing on the ground. And again, you were a part of the delegation that went to Haiti literally about 3 months before the earthquake. You remember that memorable scene with President Préval on the steps of the Capitol?
Yes.
It was an iconic photo that we still have. That was a proud reflection. I think that delegation had almost 70 people in it. So, again, thank you so much for your work, and best to your wife.
Thank you, and best to your wife as well. If I may say quickly, we are planning to celebrate 40 years of service to Haiti through my organization. Can we get back together on a program specifically geared on that, okay?
Okay, we will do that. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. Okay. Well, again, it's impossible, really, to tell the story of Haitian Flag Day so shortly, but he gave a good history of it, the background, the evolution and development, the whole notion of unity through force, through unity, and the whole need still today to build out the unity. Again, on this coming Wednesday, in many communities across the U.S., at least Chicago, here in the city of New York, I would presume, in Miami, there will be celebrations and commemorations of Haitian Flag Day. It is, to me, you have lots of flags, but the Haitian flag to me is such a beautiful flag because the symbols and the imagery is so powerful in it. Shifting now, we want to remember Malcolm, and who better to help us remember the life and legacy of Malcolm than Professor James Small, who has been for many, many years a torchbearer, someone who has conducted the annual pilgrimages on the 19th and just immersed us and keeping us on point as it relates to El Hajj Malik El Shabazz, also known as Omar Wali, our black shining prince. Professor James Small, welcome again to Vantage Point.
Thank you, Dr. Ron. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing fine. Whatever I can talk about Haitian Flag Day, and we can talk about Malcolm, that's a joyous kind of day for me. And to have you here to share with us is incredibly important. Let me just start, as I start with a lot of our interviews, we probably have done this before, but I'd like for people to just remember, because you have become such an important figure globally as a global Pan-Africanist and an educator, a teacher of so many people. Just want to delve a little bit in your background. You're outside of the city of New York per se, but I'm just wondering, were your roots initially in New York or was it elsewhere? Tell us where you were born and give us a little bit about your background, Professor James Small.
Yes. I'm born on a plantation in the woods in Georgetown, South Carolina, midway between Myrtle Beach and Charleston. It's the hub of the rice plantations.
Mm.
I come out of a family that was Morris scientists, plus a family that was heavily Mason, Knights Episcopalian, Odd Fellows in terms of leadership. got involved in the civil rights movement at 14, met Malcolm at 16, went in the military less than a year after meeting Malcolm, and he was assassinated while I was away. Returned home, went to the organization, became his sister Ella's bodyguard at 21, and became the imam of the Muslim Mosque, Inc. at 22. Probably went to Mecca at 26. And in between there, you know, being a student at City College, being an administrator and professor at City College under Dr. Leonard Jeffries, and just being generally in the movement between the Black Panther Party. I was a member of SNCC for many years, NACP. Most people don't realize NACP youth was very active back in those days, and we were very militant.
Right.
And so that's my background, really, and trying to teach our history and our culture and maintain and preserve Malcolm's integrity and name. And back in 65, 66, 67, no one even wanted to take a flyer with Malcolm's picture on it. People were still that afraid. We had to take the pictures and get up 5 o'clock in the morning and put it under the windshield wipers on every avenue in Harlem. So they were forced to look at Malcolm when they opened that flyer because we couldn't hand it to people on the streets. 90% would not even take it. And we have been doing a pilgrimage to Malcolm's grave every May 19th, started by Sister Ella and the OAAU in 1965. And this year will be our 56th year.
56 years.
This annual Malcolm X Day pilgrimage. We also made a declaration on that day that this is Malcolm X Day, and we were not waiting for the government or the state or anyone to declare it. And we've celebrated it every day for 56 years.
Right. I want to go back. I want to come back with the details of this year, but I want to go back to South Carolina because I probably don't remember, and if I did, you know how it is at this stage in life, you could do it and then 4 years later forget it anyway. But you talked about a rice plantation. And the history of rice cultivation in the Carolinas is so extraordinary because it again showed the genius of our people, people coming off of, you know, where people came from. They brought that culture with them. And then you have I remember being in Youngstown, Ohio, people would talk about the Geechies, you know, the Geechee Gullah. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't say the Gullah. They would say the Geechee people and the language. And then really that trail even going into Florida and the formation of the Seminole Nation. I mean, this is one of the most fascinating parts of the history of Africans in America that many people just don't know about. So I'm wondering if you just shed a little light on it.
Yeah, I'm a part of the Gullah Geechee Nation. I'm a part of the African Nation. Great-grandmother came from Sierra Leone. Great-grandfather on my mother's side came from what is now Uganda. On Papa's side, they were here much earlier, but also a part of the Chikora Nation. The Chikora was an Afro-Asiatic native population that was here before the slave ships came, that lived along the Waccamaw-Pitty River in Georgetown County. But on the plantation, matter of fact, the plantation I grew up on was right across the river from our cousins, where Michelle Obama family, who's also relatives, grew up on that plantation. And so that piece between the PD River, the Waccamaw River, the Santee River, the Black River, that's one of the largest rice belt in America. Now the rice just grow wild, and people have built their homes, of course, along the river, but the rice still grow wild, and the birds come and people hunt them. But growing up in that area, and my grandmother was what you call a root lady or hoodoo lady or voodoo lady. We call it hoodoo there in root. She was a priestess, and she raised us in the tradition of what we then called the Gullah Geechee people, but we know now it was Yoruba, Akan, Congo. And one of my relatives was the founder of the Maori Science Temple with Drew Ali. I tried to keep some of this low-key, but I'm old now. I can tell a lot more of my story than I told when I was younger, where I'd be hunted down. And so I grew up in that tradition of this resistance of a very, it was an African village in the woods of South Carolina. And many of the things we had to do growing up in our Rites of Passage program, which was based in the church, I would later find them all being practiced in the Akan tradition and the Yoruba tradition. We didn't know then they were Yoruba or Akan. We thought they were Christians. But just as in the Latin world, we embedded ourselves into the Catholic Church. In the Protestant world, we embedded ourselves into the Protestant Baptist particular church in the South. But many of our people escaped slavery in South Carolina to form the nation that's known as the Seminole Nation.
That's right.
There's no Seminole Indians, never
was. That's right. That's
right. Seminole comes from the word Cimarron, the same word which maroon comes out of. Because in Jamaica, the Spanish was there before the English, and the Spanish called the runaways Cimarron. The English came and anglicized it and called them maroons. And in Florida, this crazy lost Irish Scottish, prison worker that settled America, they called the Cimarrons the Seminole. These are the same people, after fighting three major wars against America, winning all of them, one at a stalemate, was marching the Trail of Tears to Oklahoma Territory. And these are the people that built Black Wall Street, the same Gullah Geechee people that made up the Seminole Nation. There was a story that's never told about our people.
Right. Well, I'm glad you brought that out, because one of my dearest friends and great ally in helping to build the Institute of the Black World 21st Century, I will say his name out loud, Wayne Thompson, some people will know that name, was a Seminole freedman. And, of course, even at, so we have done some work around the Cherokee freedmen, the Seminole freedmen. I mean, that whole history I didn't really know a lot about. But because of my relationship with Wayne, and then other historians and people tracing that story, and I'm saying, wow. And when you read the history, you know, the Union generals were saying, this is not an Indian war, this is a black war, because it was the black leaders who were the chieftains, who were the generals, who were, you know, who were really, really, like you said before, they were not really ever defeated per se. And so that we need to talk more about that, and I'm glad you were able to shed some light on it. But I learned about it through my relationship with Wayne Thompson. We actually went to some of the burial grounds and whatever. Right. Now, the part about Black Wall Street is an interesting revelation as well.
Mm-hmm. My grandfather used to take us every spring to clean the mounds, the burial grounds. They have a bell and mounds, like miniature pyramids. We didn't know anything about Egypt at that time, but these mounds is where our people were buried. And we would clean them, and the items left on the grave, like the pans and the pots and the dishes and different things, put them back in decorative ways every year. We can't do it now because other people have gotten that land.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
And the government don't let you go anywhere near any of the archaeological sites, graves they're robbing and calling archaeological sites.
Right, right.
I'm glad you mentioned the Cherokee Nation, which is a false acronym for the nation in North Carolina. You know, 8 years ago, we had our family reunion on the Cherokee Reservation in North Carolina. And so many of our people have gotten so in the white thing when we went there. But there were some that always came to the family reunions. So when we got to the reservation, only those of us who came from out of town came. So I went to the dang powwow the next day and denounced everybody. So about 30 or 40 showed up at the family reunion the next day because they didn't want to own their blackness. You know, but that's part of that whole propaganda that goes on the reservation. And I don't usually talk about that part of my lineage because people think you're trying to deprobate the African part of your lineage, but that's not true because the people we call Native American was already Africans mixed with Asiatics.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
To start with. You can look in my face and clearly see who I am.
Right.
But we have an extraordinary history. The Gullah Geechee culture, the P.D. River, Waccamaw River. There's a little island in the middle of the P.D. Waccamaw in Georgetown, Paulus Island, South Carolina, that's still all black and native people.
Mm.
It's called Sandy Island. Mm. And the white, one of our family members sold a piece of land, a couple of plots, 10, 15 years ago. And this white guy wanted to build a bridge. So we went to court and tried to get the judge to save it because there's this little hummingbird, and it's, and that's the only place it nests. But the court ruling came out saving, the, not allowing the bridge, to save and preserve the African culture of the island.
Great.
And most right. people don't even know of Sandy Island because it's a river island, not a sea island.
Right, right. Well, you know, one of the things
down here, you know.
One of the things I'm very proud of is when I ran as an independent candidate for president 30 years ago, my vice presidential candidate was Asiba Tubahachi.
So, and I love very much. I knew Asiba. That was my sister. I remember when you guys ran. I missed the occasion to do the spiritual prayer over her son's rites of passage because I was in Ghana. An extraordinary woman in the Tashinnakot Nation.
Yes, I mean, right. And the other person who really, really, really would have us remember and have us embrace all of our heritage as somebody that you know and we dearly beloved too, and our dear beloved sister, Sharshi McIntyre. She would always, make it clear.
That was my heart. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. All right. Well, let's get back to Malcolm real quick. You talked about the genesis of this, the terror and the fear. And I remember in 1990, you will recall that Preston Wilcox and James Turner, a number of us got together on the same premise. We wanted to uplift Malcolm. 1990, the year of El-Haj Malik El-Shabazz, we did a whole huge organizing campaign for that reason. And, of course, the pilgrimage, such an incredible part of it. So talk to us about what's going to happen this year and what other activities will be happening on this coming Thursday.
Yes, sir. On Thursday, May 19th, the 56th year of the pilgrimage, and I think it's Malcolm's, is his 88th birthday, we are going to be at Ferncliff Cemetery at 11 a.m. sharp. Some brothers and sisters will leave from the National Black Theater. The organization this year is not providing any buses, but we are not objecting to others who are providing buses. And or people can share cars or just drive up to the cemetery. We know that there'll be buses coming from New Jersey and from Philadelphia and from Washington, D.C. and upstate. And we will do a service that will be opened, will be overseen and managed by the Sons of Africa, who's our comrades through 30-something years in this process, and the Mosque of Islamic Brotherhood will handle the Islamic aspects of it. I will preside over the entire ceremony. And what we will do is pay respect to Malcolm and to our great Queen Mother, Dr. Betty Shabazz, who's buried there with her husband on Malcolm's birthday. When we first started doing this, Brother Ron, people used to laugh at us. We only had about 3 or 4 cars going at that time, and said we were worshiping a man. And even the Orthodox Muslim community, many of them, would not go with us because they said we were worshiping a man. And we had to show them, read your Quran, read your Hadith. The Prophet Muhammad wasallam said that you should always go to the grave site and give respects to the martyrs of the struggle for freedom in Islam. Mm. Once people got clear on that, then the hordes started coming. So now we may see 10, 15 busloads, even more, 30, 40 cars, coming to pay tribute to a young man, a 39-year-old young man, who gave his life for our freedom. An extraordinary young man whose family came out of the Caribbean and out of Georgia, and who was born in the Midwest during the most turbulent times, 1925, of overt racist terrorism, similar to what we just saw in Buffalo, happening on a daily basis, whose father was murdered by the Klan in the Midwest, and whose mother was taken away and put in an insane asylum. And most people think people went to insane asylum when you were black and active, especially our women, because you were sick. No, That was the prison they put us in when they couldn't convict us of a crime.
Right.
And it was harder to get out of that prison than it was to get out of the penitentiary. So look at the years it took before Malcolm could retrieve his mother. But in the course of his growing up, family stepped in. They weren't orphans and alone. They were initially orphaned out, but members of their family stepped in. And Malcolm's sister, Ella, people like to say his half-sister, me and Ella used to laugh, and she used to say, which half am I? You know? That was his sister. And he was brought to Boston in his early teen, just became a teenager, and he was raised in the house, not just by Ella, but Ella's husband, Kenneth Collins, and his father's two sisters, Aunt Gracie and Aunt Sarah. Aunt Sarah was a school teacher who graduated from Morehouse. Spelman. And Ella was a Spelman woman who didn't graduate. Aunt Gracie was a homemaker. These three black women from Georgia raised Malcolm X.
Right.
Okay. That he got into the streets, the myth of the big-time criminal, Malcolm was never no criminal. He was a juvenile delinquent.
Right.
He was a teenager. Right. Okay. Doing what most of us did. I did most stuff than Malcolm. I just didn't get busted for it. Okay. And I got away with it. All right. You probably did too.
No question.
And he got caught. And he wrote a book on his life. And he exaggerated that aspect, and it's clear to see the exaggeration. But when you look at his age, you see most of those activities happening when he was a teen. And even when he was hanging out in New York, supposedly the hustler, he would say bringing women from downtown and selling drugs. That ain't that big time. He wasn't even doing all that because the man had a full-time job on the train between New York and Boston.
Right.
So he had his weekends in New York to hang out and have fun. And he crossed the wrong guy, and he had to leave New York in a hurry. And the extraordinary thing, when West Indian Archie went after him, the man that helped him escape was a guy named Bumpy Johnson, who became his best friend until the day he died.
Wow.
Yeah. And him and Bumpy would play chess every Sunday, according to Bumpy's granddaughter, Margaret, who died a few years ago. And that was nothing unusual because Bumpy Johnson beat Bobby Fischer twice at chess.
And wow.
And Bumpy was also a poet. He used to go to Langston Hughes Poetry Workshop. So him and Malcolm was best friends. And he had assigned his men after Malcolm left the nation to guard Malcolm. 2 weeks before Malcolm's death, Malcolm asked Bumpy to pull his people back because at that time Bumpy was flirting at the edge of dealing with heroin, trying to retake Harlem, and Malcolm didn't want to identify with that. But Bumpy never pulled his people back. He left two people on Malcolm, led by a brother named Sunni Malik, who was one of my mentors and teachers, and God bless his soul now. But the federal government arrested those brothers the week before Malcolm got killed and sent them to Atlanta Federal Penitentiary without charges. Just like they swept the street of Jamal and those brothers in the Blood Brotherhood, and send them on the Erie Lackawanna up to Mattawan Youth Prison the week before Malcolm's death. Those were the people that would have guarded Malcolm that day. And on the morning of Malcolm's assassination, Black Diamond with two carloads of brothers, and Sonny Carson was a part of that team, who was coming to be Malcolm's cover, got stopped, both carloads, with suspicion of a stolen car, and held overnight. So they cleared everybody from around Malcolm that would have saved him that day. And the few brothers that were there got there weren't enough. Because at least, if you look at the stage at any given moment, there's at least four undercover cops on that stage, not four little Gene Roberts. Gene probably was the only cop up there that would have died for Malcolm. And some people may not like me saying that, but he was a black teenager who had become a policeman, and he was placed undercover. And he wasn't the only one. There were federal people in there. There was CIA in there. There was FBI in there. There was Justice Department. They were all in there, and they were all in on killing Malcolm.
Right. Well, but Professor Small, we're running out of time. We only got a minute left. So what a wonderful, wonderful interview with you always. But let's give people a phone number or website. How do people get in if they want to get in touch about with the information? Yes. Can you just give out again the information about the pilgrimage on Thursday?
Yeah, go to Professor Small, AfricanWorld.com.
Professor Small, AfricanWorld.com. Okay.
AfricanWorld.com. Or you just go to Facebook, James Small.
Right. And will there be anything in the evening?
We're not having a program, but there will be a program hosted by the Shabazz Center. I think it's at 7 p.m. You can go to the Malcolm X Betty Shabazz Center to Eventbrite, and you can get tickets. There's going to be an event that evening with the young people. And then midday, you've got the December 12th, starting at 1 to 4, closing down 125th Street.
Yeah, and NACO, the organization NACO, is also having something, an awards piece on that day as well. Professor James Small, thank you so much. We got to come back and just do an hour. You know what I mean? This is so wonderful. We just got to do more because you are just such a powerful, powerful, powerful a person, and we appreciate you so much for protecting the legacy of Elhaj Malik El-Shabazz and the work that you've done. So thank you so much for being with us on Vantage Point this afternoon.
Peace and blessings.
All right. Well, you heard it right here. And wow, enjoy Haitian Flag Day and also participate in and be a part of the pilgrimage and the activities on May 19th, Malcolm X Day. This is the Professor Dr. Ron Daniels saying we'll see you again next week here on Vantage Point.
FW in Washington, and WBAI New York. I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns with some brief news headlines. The United States has reached 1 million reported deaths from COVID-19, according to figures from the CDC. The tragic milestone comes just 2.5 years into the pandemic. And while the daily toll of COVID-19 deaths in the country has slowed in recent months, that could soon change. On May 4th, for the first time in months, the CDC warned it predicted the pace of new COVID-19 deaths would, quote, likely increase nationwide over the coming weeks. The U.S. has had more deaths per capita than Western Europe or Canada. As the Associated Press reports, 3 out of every 4 deaths were of people 65 and older. More men died than women. Black, Hispanic, and Native American people have been roughly twice as likely to die from COVID-19 as their white counterparts. It is also expected that the U.S., like other countries, has undercounted the true number of deaths from the coronavirus. The average number of new U.S. cases climbed above 91,000 today, a more than 50% increase since 2 weeks ago. The northeastern U.S., led by Rhode Island, is experiencing the largest per capita case rate increase of any region, according to the New York Times. Nationally, hospitalizations are up over 20% since 2 weeks ago, while a gradual reduction in death rates has tapered off. The number of COVID patients in ICUs has increased 15% over 2 weeks. New York City is averaging over 4,300 new cases each day, out of over 10,000 new cases statewide. Maryland and Virginia have experienced case rate increases of 84% and 74%, respectively. Swedish Prime Minister Magdalena Andersson announced yesterday that her party, the Social Democrats, had decided that Sweden should join the NATO military alliance. Her party voted in a meeting yesterday to support working toward applying to join the Western Military Alliance, setting up a vote in Parliament. Just hours earlier, Finland formally announced that it too would seek to join NATO. Andersson said Sweden's military non-alliance had served it well for 200 years, but Russia's unprovoked invasion of Ukraine showed the policy, quote, will not serve us well in the future, end quote. The invasion demonstrated that the Kremlin is, quote, prepared to use violence to achieve their political objectives and that they don't hesitate to take enormous risks, Andersson said. Turkey, which is a member of NATO, had voiced concern over Finland and Sweden joining the military alliance, but it is not expected to veto their membership. Turkey has long accused Sweden of supporting the PKK, or Kurdistan Workers' Party, which is banned in Turkey. In domestic news, the Biden White House is expected to announce an agreement to reopen the country's largest infant formula manufacturing plant and ease import rules on the products amid a nationwide shortage. The shortage came after safety issues forced shutdowns at a plant in Michigan earlier this year. Brian